this next panel and listening to these next individuals who, of course, are themselves county officials and who have been experimenting with public engagement in a range of issues in a range of ways, some for some time. So I'm going to ask that maybe as a beginning we just ask them each to introduce themselves, and then we'll talk a little bit about how we're going to work this next couple hours.
My name is Pablo Ogren. I'm the Director of Public Works.
Director of Public Works for the County of San Luis Obispo, and I've sort of been engaged in public issues for about 20-some years now, and I'm glad to be here.
I'm Tim Snellings. I'm the Development Services Director with Butte County, and I have a little project I'll talk about called Butte County General Plan 2030.
Okay. Teresa Castellanos, Office of Human Relations, Immigrant Relations and Integration Services in Santa Clara County.
Hi, I'm David Bosch. I'm the county manager in San Mateo County. I've been there for about 3 years now.
My name is Matt Rexroad. I'm a county supervisor in Yolo County. I'm here just to the west, and I was the mayor of Woodland prior to that. And when I'm not a supervisor, I run a political consulting firm, Meridian Pacific, and we run campaigns all over the western United States.
So without further ado, I want to actually invite David Bosch to begin. I did want to mention one thing that I forgot to mention in our previous conversation. The Institute has put together something called Legal Issues Associated with Social Media, a heads up for local agencies. It's on our website. And because we were talking about that area, I wanted to mention that briefly, so thank you. So, David, you're on.
Great. Thanks a lot, Terry. Well, I'm pleased to join with you this afternoon. I apologize I wasn't able to be here this morning. I'm sure I would have learned something from the conversation you're having. What I'd like to do is just talk a little bit about civic engagement from my perspective and given some of my experience attempting it in a number of different jurisdictions, some of the reasons why you might consider it important to the work we do, and then some of the benefits that I think derive from effective civic engagement. So I hope this doesn't repeat too much of what you might have spoken about earlier, but at the risk of that, let me just say that from my point of view, civic engagement really isn't something in addition to the work that we do as counties. It really is the way that we do effective public service. And we've really tried to instill that as a mindset change in all of our employees, regardless of the role or responsibility they have in the organization. So while we're fortunate to have Marshall Wilson as a part of the group this afternoon, Marshall's our public information officer in San Mateo County, I think I kind of blew his mind a couple of years ago when I told him that while public information was important, what I really wanted to do is redefine his role as our civic engagement person, because I think that really is indicative of the mindset shift that I think will advantage local government both today and in the future. If you think about communities, they become more and more complex. They become more diverse in terms of not only the peoples that we serve, but also in terms of the opinions and attitudes and interests of our residents. And I think if you couple that with the fact that issues themselves are getting more complex, the fact that we have fewer public resources available to us to address some thorny public policy issues, all that together means that we need to find new and better ways of engaging our community. And to do that, I think we need to really embrace the notion of civic engagement as a fundamental way in which we do our work. You know, there's lots of studies that have been done, lots of books that have been written about an apathetic public, a public that doesn't trust its government. And I think in large measure we're responsible for that because, you know, having taken some of the best practices from the private sector from the 70s and 80s, we got this attitude about, you know, treating our residents as customers. And so they then look at their government as kind of a vending machine of services. And I think what we need to now do is really go back to the way things were and take more of a barn-raising attitude or approach to local government work. all too often, I'm sure we'll hear from some of the panelists about the fact that the only way in which we seem to be able to engage the public is when there's a controversy, either in their backyard or a controversy of such gravity or scope that we're able to get a large turnout. And while some of us might think that, you know, the public hearing process, whether it's the Board of Supervisors, whether it's the Planning Commission, whether it's these formal bodies that contribute to the public policy agenda, you know, that's civic engagement. In fact, I would suggest that that's not. Civic engagement, to me, is something fundamentally different. I was actually just as a part of a discussion this morning where somebody was talking about, if you think about civic engagement as a continuum or a spectrum, on the one end you have different approaches that we take to inform our public, to educate them about the issues that are being dealt with, decision-making apparatus that exists, and we spend a lot of time trying to inform the community about the work we're doing and the importance of it. And on the other end of the continuum, some communities are actually experimenting with giving actual decision-making authority to the public, to the community. Some of them do this on a small-scale basis. They might make grants available to community groups that want to undertake work or projects, and they give them full authority to decide what the project will be and how they're going to spend the funds. Well, if you see this as kind of a continuum with information education on one end and actually delegating responsibility or decision-making on the other end, then there's a lot of places along that continuum where we can focus our work. In the center somewhere is probably something around a real deliberative process where begin to identify what some of the choices are and see whether we can get meaningful, broad-based feedback on which is the preferred alternative. And so that's a form of civic engagement, and that's one that many communities are kind of now just moving towards. And I would suggest that that's a logical kind of next step, moving from information to a more active role for our residents. But there's more to it even than that. Before I came to the county, I was a city manager in Menlo Park, and we had an experience there where we had a very serious budget problem, and so we decided that we needed to change entirely the way in which we were going to solve that problem and to do it in a way that was much more engaging of the public. And so there's been some case studies written up by the Institute for Local Government, and it's one example of how you can use a really robust civic engagement process help in answering some questions, making some difficult choices, and as a result having a really strong sense of not only what the community priorities are, but assuring yourself ultimately, if you're the supervisor or the council member, that the choice you're about to make is really grounded in intimate knowledge of the community. Finally, I'd just say, to the extent that we can be more successful in engaging our public, I think we build stronger communities overall. So if you read Robert Putnam's book about Bowling Alone, if you think about the challenge we have in garnering sufficient support, whether it's to ensure that the priorities that are identified are in fact representative of the broadest interests of the community and not just the narrow or special interests, or if in fact, as we're all challenged financially these days, if you take the question to your community about what are we going to do vis-a-vis this financial problem. Are we going to continue to reduce services across the board in certain areas, or are we going to look at other ways to address the needs of our community through tax measures, through new partnerships, through other methods? So I think that ultimately the goal is to really get our citizens back involved with us, so it's not a we they, it's an us approach to local government.
Thank you very much, David. What we're going to do, we're going to run through each person. We'll make some brief comments, and we'll, similar to the consultant panel, we'll ask a few questions of the panel and then ask if you would have comments or questions of the panel as well. So I think, let's see, got a back here. Not make sure, sorry, turn the page to see who's next. Teresa's next. Thanks, Teresa.
Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the work that we've done in Santa Clara County. I come from the Office of Human Relations, and we are the human and civil rights arm at the county level of county government. And so as part of our program, we have a dispute resolution program, conflict resolution program. We have a jail observer program. We have a youth task force. We have immigrant programs, and we have a hate-free network. And so what we do as an office is that we try to respond to human and civil rights issues by having a planned response for these key areas, but we also focus on community building and bridge building, because the idea is that we all live in a community together, and how do we work together? We are a unique office. We are, I think, the only county that's actively invested in immigrant services for the last 15 years nationwide. So we have we fund programs for immigration legal services. We fund programs for immigrants applying for citizenship. We fund programs for community education so that people know their rights and their responsibilities and how to participate and become engaged. We did an 18-month research project in which we involved over 300 people, service providers and immigrants, to look at what was the immigrant reality in Silicon Valley. In Silicon Valley, 40% of the population is immigrant. So not looking at Latinos, not looking at Asians, overall 40%. If you count immigrants and their children, that's 60% of the families in Santa Clara County are immigrants. So if we look at it from that perspective, that means 60% of the county has experiences, relationships, attitudes towards institutions that are different from having grown up in the United States. They bring with them whatever their perspective of government is, they bring it to Santa Clara County. And Santa Clara County is very successful in the economic sense of all the wealth that people are bringing in, but I think they're also very successful in the people sense of the bridge building that we've done between communities, of the work that we've done to not have conflict among all that diversity. As part of the work that we do in Santa Clara County, we do have a Citizenship Day that takes place in 14 different languages. That doesn't happen anywhere in the country, not even in New York. And when people ask us, well, how did you get that many people to come together to do it simultaneously in 14 different languages, our response has been, you know what? We asked. It has not been that hard. Of course, you know, where you have very entrenched immigrant communities with all this history with them, for example, San Francisco, you know, there might be conflict of you supported that candidate, you didn't support me in this. But in our county, yes, there's been a Latino community there for 150 years, but the other communities have been there for the last 20 years. And so, and in that context, also the Latino community is very willing to participate, to be part of, and we've discovered that at least in the immigrant community, government can play a role of convener. Because a lot of the immigrant leaders are looking at how do I bring more resources to my community? How do I bring access to my community? Even how do I give myself credibility by being able to work in the institutions? So we've been able to accomplish a lot in a short time period. Also, we've also decided to invest. It hasn't been something that happened by accident. It has been something that we've said, this is important, we're going to invest in it. So besides investing in immigrant programs, we also have an immigrant hotline in three different languages where immigrants can call and ask any question about being in the United States, whether it's about public benefits, education, I got stopped by the police, where did I get this resource? We also have invested in Second Harvest Food Bank so that there's culturally appropriate food, because when welfare reform happened, we figured out people aren't going to get food. We know they're hungry. Well, we're not giving them food that they're used to. So we've also done that several times. And the other thing is that we have had for at least 20 years prenatal care for any pregnant woman in Santa Clara County. I mean, if they're going to be U.S. citizens, they might as well have prenatal care, because that way we don't have to invest more money when the children are born and they haven't had access to medical assistance before the child was born. And so a lot of these things are not, you know, they're not like huge, but they're with the idea that government represents everyone that lives in that county, not just the people who vote, not just the people who speak English, but how all of us together take care of each other. And I think it's been a very exciting experience, because then you also open yourself to everything that the immigrant community can bring. You know, these are communities that come with resources, that come with experience, that come with leadership, and there's very few opportunities that people are given to actually exercise that, because they come into a structure where, you know, you're either the janitor or you're working, you know, 60 hours a week in high tech. So there's very few avenues to also share all that civic knowledge that you have. And so where we've been able to tap in as a county is to say, come to the table. Let us know what you're thinking. We've had dialogues with the immigrant community in diverse issues, even around conflict, we've had dialogues. And the idea is not that we come in and tell you what to do, but that we create the space for you guys to talk to each other and you decide what it is that you want to look at. And so in Santa Clara County, we've had we've had a lot of successes that I've gone and spoken to nationally, and people are like, well, how did you do that? And I'm like, well, we tried. And, you know, when you include people, people are willing to participate. And that, to me, has been a most amazing part of this. And as part of the immigrant work that we do is that we also work with the general public around immigrant issues. So the idea is not just to educate the immigrant community about how to function in the United States, but to also work with the general population on how do you work with the immigrant community. So we developed a speakers bureau with 30 immigrants from 15 different countries of origin who go around and speak about their immigration experience. So they go to social services, they go to the courts, they go to the foundations, and they talk about, you know, as a Somali, how do you deal with dispute resolution in your community? As a Mexican, how do you deal with the issue of mental health issues? And so you have people speaking for themselves, not government speaking for people, but people speaking for themselves. And I think all of this is very important in that whole idea of what is government. Government is changing. Government is not going to be the same in the next 5 years. And if we don't have community members that are involved, you know, how do we make the decisions about what the priorities are? You know, how do we make the decisions in such a way that we take advantage of the diversity and not cause divisions in the diversity? And how do we make sure that we have access for everyone? Because if you look at least at the county government level, we're about the safety net. And so the safety net is how do you provide access for people who need it in the times that they need it? And how do you have that conversation about how we continue to take care of each other during difficult times? So I think that is a little bit of what we've done in Santa Clara County.
Thank you. Next, I believe, is Matt. You're on.
Thank you. Can everyone hear me? I guess I would start out by saying that this is kind of the way I kind of thought the conversation would go today, and that and this is really more, I guess, a little bit from being a supervisor, but more from looking at, you know, voting trends in our state for a long time. But people who are in this room today, we're not like everyone else. I hope you all understand that. You all are very aware of local government. You know who's on the city council. You have an opinion. Whether you like him or not, you have an opinion of the governor. Probably can name, tell us who the lieutenant governor is right now. There's all these different things you can do because you are engaged and you're true believers in local government. And I get that, and I'm with you. But the general population is not like us. They're just not. And you can sit there and say, well, that's terrible. We're pure. We do great things. And you get really mad and passionate about it. And I hear you. But that's not what the person who lives two doors down from you is thinking. They're thinking about their business or their kids or thinking about other things to run their life. I mean, that's what they're thinking about. They're not focused on a public works project that's happening in your county. That's not their deal. And I have a couple stories that kind of illustrate this for me. When I was the mayor of Woodland, we went back to Senator Boxer's office, and I went with the police chief and the fire chief from Woodland. And we were back there lobbying for some sort of federal funding for law enforcement officers. And this young woman who worked for Senator Boxer, and it wasn't the senator, but it was one of her staff people, I'm sure a junior one, we were talking about police officer funding, and the police chief and the fire chief were with me, and I don't think she got to meet the police chief when we started this conversation. And he was dressed in civilian clothes. He wasn't wearing his uniform. And as we're having this conversation, it was pretty clear to me that she wasn't quite, you know, getting exactly what we're talking about in terms of law enforcement protection of Woodland. I said, well, you know, Woodland's a community of about 54,000 people. It's, you know, 11 o'clock on a Tuesday, whatever. How many officers do you think are on the streets of Woodland right now? And she said, 200. And I was like, well, you know, you're not really even close. And she said, 300? I'm like, you're going the wrong direction. You know, you're not going the right direction. And the answer was 5. It could have been as many as 7, but it was probably about 5. So I told her 5. And she basically was like, well, that's not possible. And I said, well, this is the police chief. Ask him, you know. And he's like, well, actually, it's, you know, 5. He said 6 or something like that. And she was in shock. And I was just kind of like, well, you know, this is somebody who's very involved in the process who just doesn't quite get what we do in local government. And so then I asked, I said, well, what do you think the budget is for the city of Woodland? You know, we have 300 employees, and you know, I just told her there were 5 police officers straight at one time. She said probably about $1 million. I was like, well, you know, wow, this is just not getting there. And so I've actually repeated this exercise several times talking to school groups in my community. When I go and stand in front of them, I go, hey, what do you, you know, tell me about Woodland or county government. You know, how many people you think work there, you know? And the answers range from just, I mean, actually never are any of them actually even close. They're either ridiculously low or ridiculously high at one extreme or the other. And the police officer one is a prime example. The other example I would give is that in 1996, I participated in some focus groups in Torrance, California. And I actually have gotten to tell this story once in Torrance, California after the fact. But at the time, make sure I get the year right, but President Clinton was running for re-election with Vice President Gore. And they'd been in office for 4 years already. And Bob Dole and Jack Kemp were the Republican nominees. And we had a group of 24 people come through a focus group in this evening. And in the course of these 24 people who were declined to state voters in Torrance, California, one person could name the Vice President of the United States. One. Now, this is not, you all can do that, and when I say these names, you know who these people are. But it's an illustration to try to show you the general public is not paying as close to attention to what's going on in everyday affairs as you all are, or we are in this room. The other part of it is that I'd like to bring out and point out is that I was the mayor of Woodland prior to this, and people assumed that I had they kind of know what the mayors do. Or at least you think you do. I mean, I'd get the strange calls about, you know, my kid's not doing well in school. You need to do something about it. And I'd be like, oh, have him study more. I don't know. You know, I don't have an answer to that. I got a frog in my pool was my favorite one, actually. It's like, look, it's your frog, lady. You can do whatever you want to do with it. You can eat it. You can keep it as a pet, whatever you want to do. But as a supervisor, my calls, number of calls, has gone down dramatically. And Yolo County is a little bit different. I actually represent fewer people on the Board of Supervisors than I did in the city of Woodland because of the way our county works out. But people just don't call me, and they just don't. I have to go out and seek out people to help. And part of it is, and I believe this is true, in the city of Woodland we deal with police, fire, parks, streets, things that everyone cares about, things that people who our neighbors and voters and our civic leaders really do care about. In the county, if somebody gets mistreated at the Monroe Detention Center from their DUI arrest last night, or is that the kind of person that's going to pick up the phone and call a county supervisor and say, you know, I don't like the way my food was cooked? They're just not likely to do that. Tell you what, if there's a pothole on College Street and my neighbor hears about it, my cell phone's ringing. When I was the mayor of Woodland, they want that fixed and they expect that. Most of the people we serve in county government aren't likely to be involved in the process. And the woman who just presented talks about our social safety net. When people are hitting the social safety net in county government, the last thing they're going to do generally is call their county supervisor and want to fix for the whole thing. They want to fix for their individual problem. And they're not likely to call me and say, hey, I really think this, you know, that we need to bring back some sort of federal welfare reform to be able to deal with my issue. That's not what they're thinking about. They want a solution to their problem that day and has nothing to do with their scope of the world is themselves. And I'm not accusing them of being selfish, but that's the reality of it. They've hit that social safety net and they care about themselves. And I totally understand that and buy it. The other part of it is that actually, when I say I have a colleague, Helen Thompson, who's on the board with me, she gets really mad when I say these things because she argues for purity all the time. You know, county government is so pure, we do such good things. And I don't disagree with her. And we can sit there and argue about how pure we are all day long. And actually, we would all probably sit around and say, yeah, we are pure. We're great. But it's a question of how you get people involved. And that's really what we're here talking about, how you involve these people. I have decided, personally, that there's always going to be people in the community that are mad about something. And they're going to be mad because they didn't get notice. No matter how many public hearings you hold, and the previous panel, as I was in the back of the room, I heard them talking about a development. No matter what, on the day of adoption, they're going to be there and they're going to be mad. I just accepted that to be true. And the real question is trying to weed through their complaints to find out whether there's anything truly at issue there and whether they really weren't notified or if they really weren't paying attention. I have a problem if people aren't notified. I don't have so much of a problem if people aren't paying attention. That's a very different thing for me. And so I really try to focus, at least in my community, on those people who I can make happy. And those that I can't make happy and I have no choice of it, I have no chance of making them happy, I kind of forget about those people because, you know, if I spend all my time with them, I can't accomplish other things. And then I want to throw out one other thing before I talked about social media. Your communities, I don't know your communities. I don't pretend to. I know Woodland, and I know it pretty well. But there's about 300 people in Woodland who are truly involved every day in the community. And actually, they move like a pack from one event to another. They go to the Chamber of Commerce event, then they go to the Rotary Club, and they roll through the community like a herd. And if you want to talk about community involvement, people who are really involved in local government, and some of you are laughing and nodding your heads because you know it's true. You see them all at the same event. You know, oh, did you go to the Chamber event? Well, no, I didn't, because I went to the Rotary event the night before and the same people were there. It's the same group of people. If you have control or community input from those 300 people, we can argue and say it's 500, your community leaders are generally covered. But those are not representative of the people who live two doors down from you. They're too busy. They're doing their thing. And we've all had those times in life where you've been more involved in different parts of the community than others. It's understandable. You have sick kids. Your business is struggling. You know, whatever those things are, you get there and do that. I have found that Facebook and websites and things like that and Yolo County 101, which I'm going to talk about in a second, are great opportunities to be able to do that. And I have this network of people, some of which I've never met before. And this summer, I've actually convinced my wife that we're going to throw a party at my house for people from Woodland who are my Facebook friends. Just invite them all over. We'll just do Diet Coke and beer and just turn it loose. And that's the only way we'll send people out, is to be able to do that. Because there are, and actually, my observation is, it's a lot of people who are very busy, who don't get a chance to do that, or they're at their desk or whatever, and they get a chance to be able to communicate, and they like being able to send me a message on Facebook. Every reporter at the Daily Democrat, our local newspaper, is on Facebook. That's how they choose to communicate with me all the time. They do it in the middle of meetings. I probably shouldn't be. Our county council's not here yet. She'll have some Brown Act problem with that. But they send me notes from their sitting 12 feet away from me in the middle of the meeting. They'll ask a question, and I'll respond that way. There's a lot of people who use that world, and we can complain, whether it be bowling alone or some of these other examples where we say, you know, society is being siloed and people aren't talking to their neighbors and whatever else. For some people, their whole silo of the world is on their computer. That's their deal. And I fully understand that. People say, well, that's wrong. We should have them reaching out and talking to each other and having cocktail parties or whatever they have, but that's the world they live in, and sometimes they can't communicate until 2 in the morning. But an email is way easier to send to me than to appear at office hours or show up at my office. And so one of the things that I did, and I'll close it with this, or at least my comments, and Mindy Nunes, who is our human resources director over there in pink, we should all be listening to her, because she's absolutely a fabulous department head in Yolo County, and we could probably all learn a lot from her. But I started this Yolo County 101, and my starting of this process was when I was running for supervisor. Nobody had any idea what the supervisor did, and I was just really mad at my predecessor, and I just really needed him to leave office, and so I ran against him. But nobody had any idea what supervisors did. They had no idea about the social safety net, because I believe that very few people who actually use county services in Yolo County are actually that group of people who use county services is not politically active. We can argue about that, and we can fight about it, but I just don't think that's the case. And so we didn't have any advocates. In Woodland, we've passed sales tax. Last Tuesday, we passed a quarter-cent sales tax to fund our library and public safety. Davis has done the same thing. We built a community center and a police station by passing a half-cent sales tax when I was mayor 4 years ago. But Yolo County, I believe, wouldn't have a chance in the world of passing a sales tax measure for the county. And the reason I think that way is, when people say, where are you from? Do you say you're from Yolo County? No, you really don't. You say you're from Woodland or Davis or West Sacramento or Winters, and that's where 90% of our population is, but you never say, I'm from Tulare County. You hear people say, I'm from Visalia. And there are some exceptions to that. Orange County, they're from Orange County. They say that. You rarely hear cities. You hear some other people talk about different counties where they're from and associated with. And actually, here's San Mateo County, so good for you. But you don't hear that in Yolo County ever. And there's a big difference there to be able to do that. So we created Yolo County 101 to teach people about the county so we could have some advocates out there. So when problems come up in the county, they come up with every organization, to be able to create. We've had 3 years now, Mindy, probably about 20 people each time, 30 people each time. First night we had about 70 people show up in the first year that we did it, which was great. But we now have about, I hope, 70 or 80 advocates for county government. And they are the people who are very involved. But they didn't know, I didn't know, as the mayor of Woodland, I didn't know that much about county government. Having them learn more about it, meet the department heads. When we have a problem, they're the letter writers. They're the ones who write letters in. They're the ones placing comments at the bottom of articles on our local newspapers. I want those people on our side. And the more they know about what we do and the good people that work for the county, I think that's a good service for everyone, especially our employees when they're getting beat up from time to time, to be able to have people step forward and go, hey, yeah, I met that department head. She knows what she's doing. She's a very good manager, and the reason they're doing that is this. And I've had a couple of really good experiences where I've been out in the community where people have come, you know, I've just been getting pummeled. And somebody go, well, no, Matt's actually been. He's been involved. He's wanted to show off the county. He's not hiding anything, and I think that's been helpful. So that's it for me.
Thank you very much.
Pavel? I'm next.
You're next.
I'm Pavel, and I'm from the Central Coast. You know,
Matt was talking about, are you from a city or a county? And, you know, from San Luis Obispo, I go someplace and there, people are, well, what's that? Where's that? And it's like, well, halfway between Monterey and Santa Barbara. And, you know, the idea of community identity, I think, is very, very important in what we're doing. In San Luis Obispo County, as a county government, we have both, you know, a lot of unincorporated areas, especially small. Our northern county is kind of cowboy country. Our north coast is the environmental and the, you know, the ex-hippie population, and then San Luis Obispo on the south coast is a little bit more of the yuppie feel. It's still a predominantly white county, and yet we still have a lot of different types of diversity even within that population, and knowing your communities I think is extremely important. Before I get going, I have a few slides, not a lot, but I think in talking about a project as an example and some of the themes that we used in our public engagement is sometimes helpful in these situations. But again, following up on Matt's example of who is the Vice President of the United States, another one that I saw was our former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor was on the Jon Stewart Show maybe about a year or so ago. And after she had retired, she's gotten involved in public engagement in civics because she was really concerned about the lack of knowledge in our country about how government works. And she quoted the Annenberg Foundation did a survey a couple years ago where only one-third of the population in the United States can name the three branches of government. Jon Stewart then quoted another survey that said 80% of us can at least identify one person who's a judge on American Idol. And they had a really woody conversation, but I think that is some of the challenges that we face. On the Los Osos Wastewater Project, in running through some of the themes, I sort of want to do a little bit of a setup of what we walked into about 4 years ago, because it was a project that I didn't initiate and our department didn't initiate. It's one where the slide from earlier in the morning where there's a hornet's nest, you know, and somebody hit the rock and all the hornets are flying around. Well, about 4 years ago, we got asked if we wanted to walk into the middle of that hornet's nest after somebody else had already thrown the rock through it. Because one of our little communities, it's a beautiful community, and there's a picture of it behind me right now, had been struggling literally for about 30 years with trying to figure out how to comply with the regional board requirement to convert from septic tanks to a community-wide sewer system. And it's about a population of 12,000 people are within the zone that has the sewer. The overall community is about 14,000. And so they had a community services district, and of course, you know, the county has no authority over the CSDs. The CSD had actually gotten as far as getting all their permits. They started construction on the project, and 2 weeks later, there was a recall that took out a majority of the board of the CSD. The new board came in, stopped the project, you know, led to multiple lawsuits, and the largest per capita municipal bankruptcy in the nation's history, as far as we know, and the first one that defaulted on a state revolving fund loan. So, you know, did we want to get involved in it? And the answer was no, not really. And when Paul Hood, our LAFCO executive director, was laying out the fact that the community was looking at a petition in order to dissolve the CSD, well, the county was naturally very concerned about that because if there is a dissolution of the CSD, and our statutes in California on dissolutions are very unclear because dissolutions really don't happen very much, but the county was obviously concerned about what that might mean. At a minimum, we knew we would be facing multiple years of litigation against contractors who would perceive us as being the deep pocket. And yet there was the other side of us who said, well, what are we here for? We're people who work in government, and we're really here to try to solve community problems. So we were both motivated on both sides. And yet, sort of walking into it with eyes wide open, we did about 6 months of studying because our assemblyman was willing to take forward legislation in order to help with the overall issue. And so we studied for about 6 months the dynamics of the situation, did a lot of case-specific analysis, And it's 4 years ago tomorrow that our board adopted its legislative platform. So we walked into a particular project that really, really had a lot of thorns associated with it. And so what our basic approach was was to really work with themes, not, you know, specific. We had our strategies and everything. And I've had the fortune of speaking more often with, you know, public works people, the engineers. I don't happen to be an engineer, but I've worked a long time with engineers. But work, you know, with the engineers in the public works field in terms of how do we get our message out to communities. And so this one I wanted to sort of go a little bit more broader and talk about some of the themes that we use. So the teaming, how did we approach engaging in the public in this particular hornet's nest? Our approach to town hall meetings, which was helpful. Competition, I could have said competing strategies, but I'll get to why I wanted to use the word competition then. And then democracy requires ... because I think that ultimately we just have to remember that, you know, this is part of democracy. Whether the decision happens to be one that we particularly like or don't like, the more that we remember that the foundation of what we're doing is about working in a democracy, I think the better off we are. In terms of the team itself, in our department for, you know, well over a decade now, has transitioned into this team approach of engineering, environmental, and finance. The three legs to the stool that's necessary for us to be able to move forward. We're called a public works department today. 10 years ago, we were called an engineering department. It was a bit of a challenge in the transition from, you know, the dominated engineering field into the multidisciplinary teams. But we certainly very much focused on, we weren't going to put one person out in point. We needed to make sure that we had teams. And also identifying the individuals on engineering, environmental, and finance who had the skills to go out and speak with the public, as well as the skills to know what the other one is doing. Because the better that our finance professional could speak to what the engineer was doing, or the better that the environmental professional could speak to what, you know, the finance individual was looking at, the better that at least we seemed in the public the perception of a team that knew what each other was doing. And we often hear in government the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. So we very much focused on this. With respect to the leadership and the elected officials, I had good fortune because during the legislative process in 2006, there is a supervisor, Shirley Bianchi, an elderly lady, tough as nails, didn't take, you know, trash from anybody. And walking through the committee meetings, through, you know, both the Senate and the Assembly side, her firmness on what the county needed in the legislation in order to help resolve this issue was extremely good at that time. Yet if in 2007 she was still on board and she was working with some of the, you know, community meetings and everything, it probably would have been horrific. She was retiring, and sort of her handpicked replacement, Bruce Gibson, came in. He happens to have a PhD in geology. He's an extremely intelligent person, and he's really good at finesse. So when we were going through the community meetings over the last couple of years, he's been extremely good. And then on the Coastal Commission, which since, you know, we're on the coast, and ultimately last Friday we did get a unanimous approval of the Coastal Commission of our coastal development permit. One of our board members, Katsu Asajian, is also on the Coastal Commission, so I was also good and fortunate to have political leadership on the Coastal Commission itself. And Katsu is the type of a political leader where, you know, technical details just don't matter, right? He's very much of a people person. He very much looks at things in terms of what does this group or what does this individual want versus this. And so there was a little bit more, especially on the last day at the Coastal Commission. He wanted to see it get done, but we had to give him a little bit more guidance. But knowing the elected officials, knowing the leadership from, you know, that standpoint, and making sure that we're well coordinated with them was extremely important, and we were fortunate in all three of the individuals that we worked closely with. And yet as well, I also, in talking with the staff members and the other ones who are on the project team, I remind them all that everybody, if you step up, if you're at the microphone on behalf of the county, then you are a leader. You might be a young leader who is relying more on your technical expertise right now, but the only people who get up to the microphone is somebody who's a leader. And so from day one, everybody on the team was, we considered to be leaders. Engaging the public in our approach there is, the first bullet I have here is there's no such thing as the general public. That's actually something that I heard at a conference that I went to, and I picked up and I liked it a lot. Because we know that there's tendencies, and Matt had spoke to the idea that the general public itself is usually not engaged in too much detail about government. But when we go through the day-to-day stuff in our work efforts, if we paint them too broadly as a general public, then we're really doing ourselves a disservice. You know, the idea of being able to know, you know, the diversity of communities and the different community groups and understanding them. We all know that when we go and we do speaking, we need to speak to the audience, and it's the same thing with community groups. I know that when we are speaking with the Filipino community in Los Osos, that's part of the heart of our farm working community. Very conservative individuals. They are very, very much dedicated to, you know, the United States and the country and what we're doing and everything. Very early on, knowing to address them on the needs issue and why this needed to go forward was sort of a bottom line thing for them. Some of the other groups, the environmental groups, were a little bit different. And in fact, in this case, even though it's a huge environmental project, we ended up having a lot of division there. But the point being is that being able to break, you know, it's not the general public, it's a number of different groups, and understanding the demographics and the desires of the different groups ends up being very important. I'm going to sort of sidetrack to a different project we did several years ago, and we were rebuilding a dam, and this is probably one of the more controversial diversity calls that I made, and that is that it was a hard project. We were in construction, and the contractor was coming out of us with a lot of claims. And so our technical advisory committee, which included mayors and other ones from some of the local cities that we sell water to, wanted to have a hearing about the claims and why is it that the contractor can't live within the dollars. You know, we walked into that meeting knowing it was controversial. On the same hand, the five individuals who we were speaking to were all elderly, white, and relatively conservative and good old boys in a way, right? Well, it happened to be that on our team, the budget person was a female who was about 27 years old. So I had to figure out the sequencing of who's going to speak when, right? And I've got about four people who are going to speak. And I felt like the biggest challenge with this particular group was to be able to get the actual dialogue, to get the presentation going, and to get a roll on it. Because I knew that there was one particular individual there who was going to be more likely to just start interrupting us right away and to disrupt the presentation, which just... Yet I also knew that this 27-year-old young female, no one was going to say boo to her. They were not going to be rude to her, and so we did the budget first. And we talked about it as a team, and I talked about that dynamic, but I also believe that, you know, diversity provides strength, and she would not have gone up there and done the presentation if she didn't know what she was doing. We wouldn't have selected her, but we consciously selected her to go first, because we figured that, you know, the old guys are not going to be rude to her, they're not going to interrupt her, and we're going to be able to get the presentation rolling, and that's exactly what happened. They didn't say boo to her. The next speaker came up, and he started talking, and then the individual interrupted and stuff, and I just said, you know, I jumped up and I said, excuse me, but we would really, and everybody else, you know, was like, no, let's let them do their presentation. And so there is often little details like that that become very important when, you know, that happens to be an example of when I was working with an advisory committee and some mayors and everything, and not a town hall type of a meeting, but still recognizing those situations. And then the NGOs and the other associations on this particular project, we engaged in them really, really early. That was mentioned this morning. We engaged with them early because we felt that in solving this problem, our first hurdle was just to get credibility behind what we were doing. That a lot of people would not be engaged subsequently if they just felt like we were credible going in. And so whether it was the Rotaries or the other types of groups, we did a lot of those small meetings right up front in order to try to establish credibility. On town hall meetings, on this one, what we did that was kind of interesting, especially early, and it was just the format. We were at a junior high. And around the edges, we did a meet and greet before we really got going with the presentation. And so we spent about an hour and a half. And I had a lot of individuals there who weren't even involved in the meet and greet. We had a water quality chemist there. We had different people. And each person had, you know, a small table and a couple of poster boards up. And the purpose was so that individuals in the community could come out and they could meet a lot of the people who actually work on community issues. Because so often in presentations, you know, we'll get one or two or three people, the leaders, if you will, who are actually, you know, going out and doing the dialogue. And we wanted, in this situation, to be able to really show that there's a lot of people who are working on issues. And it ended up working out successfully because, you know, it was just part of the interpersonal, in a way, where people could come and they could talk to the water quality chemist or talk to the water resource manager and talk to, you know, a lot of the finance, the accounting people, the billing individuals. And it created more of a personal situation. And then we transitioned into the presentation where the main players on the team were up on the stage and we all had different roles. But in that situation, we felt that it was extremely important because it helped to illustrate the complexity of the job and that it takes a lot of different professionals in order to tackle something like this. And then when we got to the Q&A, our elected official, our board member, was the one who sort of weeded through all the cards and asked the questions because there was a lot of antagonism. And so we wanted to make sure that we had a little bit of a filter there. The last thing on that presentation, especially the very first one we did when everything was at the height of emotions in 2007, if you will, our water quality chemist who lives in the town and doesn't normally do public speaking is an individual with a lot of heart and soul. And so she finished our presentation, and she spoke from a very personable perspective. And she goes, "Pablo, you're just going to have me go up there? You don't even know what I'm going to say?" And I said, "Lisa, all I know is you're going to say great things." Because she's just a person who has a lot. And so she did. She spoke about the community. She spoke about the need for the community to get beyond this controversy, how it had been tearing the community apart and everything. And we literally had two sides of the aisle. You know, half of the audience, there's a couple hundred people there, that, you know, we're dead set. We don't want a wastewater project because, oh, I forgot to mention it's going to cost about $250 a month. And the other half that said, you know, we need to get this done. And when Lisa finished as the last presenter there at the first town hall meeting, this was after the special legislation had passed, the whole place got up and they gave her a standing ovation. It was just incredible. And I think there's a story there that we need to get out of our shell sometimes and we need to speak from our heart, or we need to find the person who can get up there who can speak, you know, to heart and soul type of issues. And then I had put up here, too, the redundancy of written materials. This was a, you know, bar none effort. In terms of the written materials that we had at the town hall meetings or the ones that we sent out to the community, we did a lot of redundancy. It was sort of the marketing strategy. You know, when we write professionally, we try not to be redundant, but I think in communications with the public, redundancy is important. And then I'm going to go kind of quickly through these last couple ones, because on competition, some of the themes that we dealt with were just conventional wisdom versus counterintuitive. We really went counterintuitive because the community, through the legislation, had to vote on a Prop 218 assessment vote, $25,000 per single-family residence, before we even identified what we were going to do. That's counterintuitive because most of the time, if you want to try to get people to pass a tax, you got to tell them exactly what you're going to do and exactly why it's going to benefit them. But our analysis in this situation was that the property owners were just so fed up of what was going on that they were going to, you know, that they needed to approve it. We got an 80% positive vote on it. So taking the counterintuitive strategy in this particular situation was well thought out but very important. Technical discussions versus value-based discussions. A couple months ago I came up to a CSAC conference on value-based discussions. I think those are very important because especially, you know, on public work stuff, you can talk all night about the technical issues and put people to sleep really quickly. You still have to hit the technical issues and then transition, I think, into the value base real quickly. This morning, I sort of listened in a little bit in order to hear some of the dialogue. And debate versus validity, I heard something about, you know, somebody in public wanted to continue to debate somebody in this room on a particular issue, and it's a challenge because you could just, you know, you can get into those circular things. And so one of the things we tried often is to steer it away from a debate, and when possible, whomever we're talking with, recognize the valid points that they're bringing up, but then maybe transition it into the bigger picture issues. But the more that, I believe that when people show up and they have issues, most everybody has validity to their issues. And so recognizing that the validity, but then talking about bigger picture. And then action versus non-action, because often we're proposing stuff that we think is important, but we can't forget to talk about, well, what's going to happen if nothing, you know, what will be the ramifications if nothing happens. And I put it all in a competition. The idea is that some of these are competing strategies, you know, conventional wisdom versus counterintuitive strategies. But also I found that the team itself started to become very competitive against the naysayers. And in some ways it was good because the team was very motivated. You know, there was a group of people out there who just refused to believe facts, or they created their own facts. And yet, you know, that's a double-edged sword that, you know, if it's too much of an us versus them type of thing, then that can be difficult or counterproductive. And yet, on the other hand, it can also be motivational sometimes. As I touched off in the beginning, democracy requires an educated public. And I know that when we tell ourselves they don't get it, then that usually reminds us that, okay, we needed to do a better job of getting the message out. But an educated public is something that, you know, the founders of this country way back a couple hundred years ago recognize that for democracy to work, we have to have a well-educated public. And so I do believe that that's an important portion of our job. Different solutions for different communities, how important is it? This wastewater project is very important. You know, we very much came out with the theme that something needs to get done. We had a process set up where what Public Works actually put on the table in front of the Planning Commission is a whole lot different than what ended up ultimately getting approved. The flexibility that was discussed earlier this morning, we went in there with maximum flexibility and maximum responsiveness. And what we did is we said, okay, this is a minimum project that will meet the Regional Water Quality Control Board's needs, and then let the process decide how it's going to get shaped from there. And that, in theory at least, ended last Friday with a project that the Coastal Commission approved on a unanimous vote. If I didn't mention that already, I probably mentioned it many times this week. But to the extent that some of the environmental organizations were still opposed at the Coastal Commission, the effort of public engagement, even though the Coastal Commission is only supposed to be about coastal resources, their staff stressed it a number of times. We stressed it a number of times. Over the last 4 years, we've had 100 public meetings. And those are the combination of the town hall meetings, the technical advisory committee meetings, the board of supervisors meetings, the planning commission meetings, all of Supervisor Gibson's office hours. But in 4 years, 100 meetings, and I don't care what the decision-making body's formal role is, when you do the public process, that has weight, and it does. It is important at the end of the day. And then the last thing I always like to say is democracy requires big ears, and I think the theme there is that, you know, we have to have good listening skills, because if we don't, then we're going to just make our challenges even more difficult.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. So the date, November 19th, 1863. That is not the date we started our general plan process, okay? That is something else happened in 1863. That's when an address given by President Lincoln concluded with these words. It says that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people shall not perish from the earth. You know, I believe that county government is that fulfillment of what Abe Lincoln talked about. We're the government level closest to the people. We connect with the people. And not necessarily the people that want to connect with us all the time, but we are very much a part of the real world of people's lives. And one of the projects where we had a lot of connection with our community is a project called Butte County General Plan 2030. I have a little paper I handed out for you, and I thought at the end of lunch and after an hour of other speakers talking, we might need a little help staying awake, so we're going to fill in some blanks here and some very practical things. The problem, but we can't say that in county government, we say the opportunity. The problem was that Butte County had previous failed attempts at writing a new general plan. And when I started in 2005, the county had just come off of a very bad experience with the public, with its citizens, on trying to write a general plan that collapsed in disaster.
And so the county's credibility was very, very low. So when I was hired, the board said, Tim, your number one priority is writing a new general plan. So there was no misunderstanding with the board and with me about what my number one priority was. If I wanted my contract renewed, we better get a new general plan, that kind of thing. It was very clear. So the board also was very committed to, on a 5-0 commitment of getting a new general plan approved, which is also great backing and support as we launch into an effort. So the first question, or the first line, figure out who are your stakeholders. You've heard of this a lot, so that's the blank there. And for me, when I arrived in the county, I asked around. I asked people, you know, who cares about the new general plan? Who cares about the failed past general plan? And that caused a lot of lunches, a lot of coffee breaks with people. League of Women Voters is very active in Butte County. So they actually were leading towards a charge of having an initiative put on the ballot for a general plan to be adopted at the ballot box. And I convinced them, come on, give us a chance, give my team a chance to work, and please don't do that. We began a process of outreach to the communities. We set a plan in motion with our consultants that we hired, and we went out to 20 different communities. We have 42 communities in the unincorporated part of the county, 1,610 square miles of the unincorporated county, and we did outreach. We went out to listen, and we were the first county employees that a lot of people had ever talked to. They said the only county employees we've ever seen out here is a sheriff asking for directions. So it was nice to go out there and actually listen. What do you like about your community? What don't you like? And just take in information. And that's information that we fed into our process. So getting out there to those stakeholders, we sent out postcards to homes. We did obviously a lot of public ads in the newspaper. We did signs, neighborhood community signs, and things like that as part of our outreach. The board also set me up for success, is what I want to tell you with this project. In hiring a consultant, sometimes there's the illusion that if you hire a consultant, that's all you need, is the consultant. And then staff just takes what the consultant gives and then takes it to the board, and the board blesses it. That is not reality. Consultants don't know your county like your staff and your board knows the county. And the politics, the local community groups, the real issues of the history, they just are not that well connected. So they do their best with what they do, but you need a staff connection. And so the board originally set up two dedicated staff in development services to work on General Plan 2030. As we went through the down cycle, one quit and moved on, and we didn't backfill that position. But I still have one dedicated staff person. He works 24/7, I mean, with our consultant team. There are so many issues to work out, and it's critical that you have dedicated staff on a project this complex. The second blank is remember words matter. Through our process, we had a phase where the public was invited to give us ideas. Landowners were given the opportunity to give us suggestions about what the county should consider on their property. We ended up with 43 areas in the unincorporated part of the county for consideration, and I called them potential growth areas. Well, I thought that was pretty safe, potential growth areas. Well, the public didn't think so. They were livid. They said, oh, we knew it. This is a developer-driven general plan. And so we took a step back and relabeled them as study areas. The whole room went like this. And so I just want you to remember, words really matter. Third item is know the end from the beginning. That's Stephen Covey, 7 Habits of Highly Successful People. Early on, I set the vision and tried to get the community to rally around a vision. I said, look, we're going like on a sailing adventure. Have any of you ever been sailing, you know, trying to connect with the audience? And we had 150 people in a room. Said, when you sail, you know your destination. You don't know exactly how you're going to get there. You have to tack to your destination. You have bad weather you're going to encounter. You have rough seas. You've got to prepare. You've got to be equipped. You've got to have the right team. And it was just, it's just been a great analogy. I even played, and I get criticized or hassled for this all the time, Enya, the Enya song, Death by Enya, right? Of sailing away, sail away, sail away. But it helped, again, to create the vision of we're going on a sailing trip. And people have connected with that throughout the journey. Speaking of vision, people didn't, you know, I told you we had a credibility issue. And so we put together a Gantt chart, and we actually got so serious about it, we made a T-shirt with the Gantt chart. again, to try to, we're still working on credibility with people and say, look, we're really committed to this thing. And so, again, part of having fun was producing this Gantt chart. Our consultant got a little nervous when we did that. Mike, you're really going to hold us to this timeline? And the answer was yes. Okay, the fourth blank there is set realistic goals. I was fortunate to have a county administrator who had a significant amount of experience with some general plan challenges in El Dorado County years ago that were very difficult, and he learned a lot. So he prepared the board. He said, look, this is a five-year, $5 million task we're on, project. So he early on said, you know, this is going to take a lot of years, and it's going to take a lot of money, and we're going to commit to that. And he did, and the board did. This is kind of in the sales philosophy of under-promise and over-deliver. And again, it's about establishing credibility. If we say we're going to get this done in 2 years, and then it takes 4 years, people are getting frustrated, they don't believe us, and our word starts to become something really questioned. So it's critical that you have realistic goals. Fifth is to expect problems and challenges in the public arena. That's the rough weather on the sailing adventure. And you know what? We learned that it is the process. It's not a surprise to the process. It is the process. We had conflict. We still have conflict and debate. We have an airport land use commission that we're into it with right now. But the public has a lot of opinions. And if you are really serious about hearing what they have to say, and that's a really point of distinction, I think there's a reality test in there somewhere that you have to take of, do you really want to hear? Do you really care what people want to say, or is your mind already made up? And we had to go through that because our board, I'm not sure, really wanted to hear what the public had to say. And so the public came up with some great ideas through the process. Whoa, believe it or not. The public said, look, we need a water element. We're concerned with water exports out of Butte County, and we think that we should have a water element. They were contentious with us. They debated us. And our board said, okay, let's have a water element. And so we've incorporated a water element into our general plan. It's an optional element. We can do that. And so we had another idea that came up from this area above Oroville. It's a foothill. It's called a banana belt, where there's a lot of little olive orchard, olive groves and a few wineries. And they said, we'd like a specialty ag overlay. And again, we think we're kind of special. And the board said, okay. So these people went from being opponents to now coming into every board meeting supporting, saying how great this general plan is. And so the idea is take that energy and as much as you can, work it into the process. Something else very clear, I'll get there actually. Item number six is if you foresee potential problems, form a board subcommittee if you can. For me, a board subcommittee, and I think we have someone from the county council office here, but a board subcommittee is just two members of the board of supervisors. And for me, I tried to get, and I did, get two members with opposing views, one very environmentally leaning, one very growth leaning, and had them on a subcommittee. And it was a place where we could vet tough issues, have very frank discussions. And it actually, the way that it worked, when we work things out at the subcommittee level and bring them to the board, instead of me and our consultant team presenting information to five board members, it's actually more like two board members and me presenting information to three other board members. And it's legal. It's a good thing. It's efficient. Again, you can have real tough discussions and debates and really kind of duke it out at a subcommittee level. And it helps your process and your product get better as you take things to the board. Item seven is, if appropriate, get help from a dedicated committee. Our board approved a citizens advisory committee. We took applications from all over the county. We ended up with 31 people on a citizens advisory committee. And everyone was in shock, fear, horror, terror. You can't have a citizens advisory committee with 31 people. That just won't work. And guess what? It worked great. It really did. And we had one of the little tricks we did when we first, at our very first meeting, because we had some real personalities to deal with, as you can imagine, some people that really like to talk and things like that. We're going to really, you know, maybe run for office someday, all sorts of agendas that people had. And they, when you do the introductions, you talk about yourself and say why you're on the committee and what you do and all that good stuff. We put them in pairs and we had them introduce the other person. And it was really a nice way for people to get to know each other on the committee and for people to not talk about themselves, but to talk about. And it was really, it set a great foundation for this Citizens Committee. The board was very clear early on, this Citizens Committee, their role is to make a recommendation. Sometimes a county or city will give authority to a committee to say, we will take whatever you come up with. Our board said, we will consider whatever you come up with. And mostly they've accepted what the committee's come up with, but not always. And so the board is the last word as the policy-making body on a general plan. Okay, item number... Oh, one other thing. If you do have a Citizens Advisory Committee, we met 25 times with them for four-hour meetings, sometimes longer. We got kicked out of a few places because we stayed so late. And, you know, and we learned this from Marin County's work on their general plan, is we feed them. And it sounds kind of silly, but it really, again, eating food together does something, pulling a group together. And it gives that casual time. You kind of connect when you have a meal together. And it's one of those subtle little things that really helped connect our group, as silly as that sounds. Our cookies, we got kind of teased, you know, our Costco cookies we'd always have. And but they, if you didn't bring them, boy, they were sure asking, where are the Costco cookies? I mean, it's just kind of funny. We videotaped all those meetings. We put those meetings on our website. We don't have somebody talked about having the resources in the county system to have like a video server. We didn't have that, so we used YouTube for a while. Then they cut their limits, and we went to Google Video. They cut their limits, and now we're on Vimeo. But there are public, you know, free sites out there that you can run video on, and someday we'll get the video on our county site. So and it's come in very handy, too, where there's been some debate about what did the board decide. We've gone back to those videos and looked and said, oh, there we go. Now we get it. Clear board direction. Okay, we got it. And it's really helped us in the process. Item 8 is put your opposition to work on the project if you can. We had an individual early on in the process come to a public meeting, a board meeting during public comment, and he asked, he had some issues with agricultural policies, and the board ended up putting him on the Citizens Advisory Committee, and he's been a great resource. Item 9 is keep your public informed, no surprises, nothing to hide. And again, the videos help, our website helps. We do an update at every Board of Supervisors meeting since November 2006 to update the board as well as the public. Every board agenda, we just did update number 77, and the public is aware of what's going on. There's no surprises to the board. We've had some course corrections along the way. We had to do some extra studies here and there. We had to delay a little bit at one point and do some additional analysis, but it's no surprises, and you can expect things to come up and happen. Again, it's a public process. Stuff is going to happen, and why not plan for it? If you try to hide it, avoid it, deny it, you'll pay for it, and it's better to give bad news first, ask staff to the board as soon as you find out, and then we deal with it, and the board does, and the board is very gracious that way. Item 10 is, and this is kind of overlooked sometimes, is to make sure you have a commitment from appropriate internal or other county departments. And we had our Public Works Department, Environmental Health, CAO's office, Ag Commissioner, Water Department, County Council, very integrated into our process. They review documents before we release them in their area of expertise. We did financial, you know, public services analysis as part of our background report. So the CAO's office was very helpful in that. Our roads, you know, we have the circulation element. Public Works has been very closely working with us on that, making sure we integrate that with our COGS work and the regional planning. And they're also very involved in our plan. The last item is sometimes the public process, the best thing that can be done is really to say, to listen to them and say thank you very much for your comments and move on. We had a lot of hot debates with our board in the board chambers, especially is where things come down to. They kind of come down like a funnel into the board chambers, and they get really narrow, specific, focused, intense, and, you know, opposing views. And in the board chambers, the board is wonderful at taking public comment and saying, thank you very much. Next. Thank you very much. And really considering, we had one guy who's been to 11 meetings. He's asked that they redesignate his property from agriculture to residential. 11 times the board has told him no, and we just keep moving on. And so it is intended for the public to engage. They feel heard. They don't always like the decision, but they do feel like they've had a voice. And so when we come on September 29th this year for the adoption of the general plan, and that person comes to the microphone and says, hey, I just heard you guys are doing a general plan update. You know, we can say we've had over 100 meetings also. We've done these things. And the board will say, thank you very much. General plan approved, hopefully. So that's the end. Thanks.
Thank you for your presentations. I was thinking, Tim and Pablo perhaps gave the most complete story of an actual full process. I might go back to the first three panels, ask whether comments, additions, anything raised for you in these in the remaining stories that came after yours, you might want to add something to or comment on in some way.
I would just add that I think, you know, public engagement can be used in a variety of circumstances. And so we've heard some good examples of public works projects, land use controversies, immigrant services. We've used them in all of those things. Sometimes it's kind of issue-driven or issue-based at least. But what we're realizing is that we just need to, and I think Matt started into this a little bit, and that is view civic engagement as really a part of having an informed public so that we can move beyond something that's just issue-driven and have a better informed community that's more supportive, more knowledgeable, and more of a partner with us. You know, I started my comments by saying that, you know, in constrained times, I think we need to look for new approaches. And I don't think that we can afford any longer for people to just look to government to solve the problem or to figure out the solution. And I think that's about building capacity in the community. And so I see civic engagement leading to stronger communities. It's more of a community-building strategy, if you will. We've done it around 218 sewer fees. We've done it about siting mental health clinics in neighborhoods. We've used it to address challenges with certain ethnic populations in the community that were unique to them, whether it was domestic violence related or other issue-based. So I think the tools apply in a variety of settings, but we need to develop the toolkit and the habits around how we use them.
So the thing that I would add is to not be afraid of the public. And sometimes we do make mistakes. But in general, my experience has been that the public will forgive mistakes. I remember once I had to do this presentation with an African Muslim community. And I paid attention to my dress. I'd been working with this community for 10 years. I thought I knew what I needed to do. I get there 10 minutes late, so I go sit next to the person that I know. Before I speak about county services, they have a guy from the FBI speaking to the public. I have a lot of questions about the FBI and the way they're surveilling the Muslim community, so I ask my questions. And at the end of the questions that I ask, the MC says, well, now let's ask the women folk what they think. And I realize I'm sitting on the wrong side of the room. I was supposed to be sitting on the other side. I'm talking way too much as a woman. And I say, oh, okay, I learned. But no one was severely offended. They knew I was an outsider. They knew I was representing government. And, of course, I get invited several times afterwards to come speak to the community. And now I pay attention to where you sit. Men and women are sitting in different areas. But it was a learning experience. And, yes, I can kick myself in the butt about it and say, okay, I made mistakes. But I can say, hey, I learned. And I think for a lot of times, community, especially with immigrant communities are very grateful to the resources that you bring, to the knowledge you bring, to the ability to access, because it's not people who are normally allowed to access information, political space. So I think when you make an effort in immigrant communities, people are generally very open to you being there, to the efforts that you make. And I think you can see that in a lot of politicians who maybe cannot speak a lot of Spanish but make a little bit of effort, and the crowd is very responsive. So I would say be very be open to it. Learn from the experiences. You know, I think with government changing, we have to learn how to work together. We have to learn how to be one community. And the way that we've seen it evolve over time is that we've had the citizenship days in 14 different languages, And when we did the census work, we could transfer 14 different languages almost immediately because people knew what county government did. People for themselves started advocating for the census and why you have to do the census and don't be afraid of government. And without a lot of investment, we had already invested 14 years in the community for them to say, oh, county government says this is important, we're going to get involved. And all of a sudden, we have 14 different community groups that we hadn't planned for involved in the census count. So I think there's a lot of fruit to be gained from working with everyone that lives and works in your county.
I would like to add one. Thank you.
You know, in thinking about the experience that I had in San Luis Obispo County, we had a flood project in Woodland when I was mayor. And this is not a condemnation of engineers at all, but some people are better at public outreach than others. They just are. And our public works director wasn't necessarily the guy that should have been out there. And he was out there because he was in charge of the department. And I think that in hindsight, as I was thinking about the comments and what happened in San Luis Obispo, we should have just gone to the number 3 person in the department and let them be the public face. I mean, and I didn't realize that until it was too late. But some people are better, and if you're really looking for the best person to go out there and be the person of the project, or you know, if there's a large community force, an example was kind of the different skills of the supervisors. But just because you're the department head and the best engineer, or maybe the best person to run the department, doesn't necessarily mean you should be the person talking to the press or speaking in public on behalf of your agency. So I guess that would just be my only follow-up comment to the stories is that pick that person appropriately, and some people are better than others.
I concur with that 100%. I try to convince everybody that I'm not the best person to go out there and speak in the public. Kidding. But, you know, when we had all these...
Thanks for coming today and speaking publicly.
like on our technical advisory committee... No, that was our environmental division manager, and it was our engineer, and both of them were on this project because they could also... We had 4 staff members, including myself, and each one of us was out there because we knew that we could speak publicly. We had all worked on it. I almost didn't graduate from college because I deferred my speech class until my last quarter of my senior year, and I almost didn't pass the dang thing. You know, it was so difficult. In fact, I had to go in and give a persuasive speech to my speech teacher on the last day of class or whatever on why he should pass me. And one of the things was, I promise I'll go to Toastmasters and do some other stuff. So it's something that, you know, people can develop. And I had mentioned that, you know, in this town hall format where we have a lot of people around but then only some of them speak, that's one of the ways that I try to get a feel for who has, you know, some of the better speaking skills, because in a way, you know, if they're at the town hall meeting but they're not up on stage, then it gives them some ability to interact with the public. And so I'll go around and I'll sort of watch them in action and see which staff members, you know, maybe have more hope at becoming, you know, good public speakers and which ones don't. But we consciously, depending on the meeting, decide who's going to speak, you know, who's the audience and how we go. And on that point, too, sort of following up on Teresa, I'm not sure how many have used translators or not, but practice, because if you're clicking with your translator, the message can go along, can, you know, be really effective. And if you're stumbling with your translator, it can be just really difficult. And I've done it on a few occasions. And when you hear the audience laughing, then usually you figure that, you're working and you're clicking with your translator pretty well. But that always takes practice, because that's almost like a relationship right there in and of itself.
Thank you. Questions you may have of one of the panelists, or more than one.
I was wondering if you could be a little more descriptive about
Yolo County 101 is I think the first time we did it was 10 Tuesdays in a row or 10 Wednesdays in a row, and kind of the mistake we made the first year was trying to jam too much into a 2-hour deal. But you know, we had this fabulous discussion with our district attorney one night, and actually probably the best one of all was Dr. Betty Hinton, when she was our public health officer, came, and we had a couple libertarians in the room, or people who had very libertarian ideas, and she explained the authority of the public health officer during a health emergency, and we had these people just about going into cardiac arrest. It was actually kind of fun. But we tried to go through the different different locations throughout the county. A lot of people would have no reason to go to some of the places, the emergency center, for example. I'm trying to think of the acronym, EOC, but Emergency Operations Center, those sorts of things. So we would do it wherever. And, you know, it is those people who are, I mean, trying to get somebody who truly is not engaged is unlikely, but there tend to be some seniors, legal woman voter types who want to be involved. But it was very helpful, and it was a good program. I did it the first year, and it was largely residents of Woodland who came, and then the board liked it. I invited a couple of my colleagues to come and introduce the topics, and then the board made it a priority for the last 2 years. And Mindy, who I obviously offended as she ran out of the room, has been in charge of it the last 2 years, and she's done a great job in terms of moving it around the county to different spots.
I might just add,
Rich Gordon, who they at San Mateo County had his own deal, and when I looked into the program, what does he call
Citizens
his?
Citizens Academy.
Citizens Academy. I called around to look to find out who was doing other stuff, and Rich had a pretty good program, so we did kind of a hybrid and fixed it to Yolo County. But there's several counties who are doing similar, or cities who are doing similar things. But Rich has a pretty good program in San Mateo County.
Just a quick, the Institute has on its website a list of many of the academies that we can find, both citizen academies, ones that are run through a police department, other kinds of non-governmental leadership. So there is a roster there with contacts in case that's ever helpful.
Matt, are you still in that 10-week? Is that still how you're functioning?
Yeah, they've mixed up the speakers a little bit. We've actually had a couple people who are really sick who have been to every one of them. They come multiple years, and because we mix up the speakers. So for them, we couldn't just keep having the same presentation over and over again. So generally, I think they might have expanded to 12 weeks or something like that, but that's been what's worked best for us. So.
There have also been some that have been done that are other than English, and they tend to focus on a particular community like Hmong community or a Russian community where folks are more likely to get a number of folks from the same community who are comfortable with another language, comfortable coming together and focused on that community. It's another way to generate additional diversity in the leadership and build capacity for participation as well. Other questions, sir?
One of the things we talked about earlier in our breakout was involving the public more in legislative operations. Two of the topics, like two of the words that came up was avoiding the whiners and the gadflies. And I guess, Matt, this is your question. How did you initially do outreach for YOLO 101, avoiding the folks that pretty much operate on lunar cycle?
Well, you can't avoid them, but you just have to, it's a question of whether they're going to dominate the discussion or not, whether you're going to...
Was it Facebook?
I did it with the website and putting news press releases in newspapers that they covered them. Newspapers like this kind of stuff, so there was really no probably start locally for us. It wasn't a problem, but in the end, I like the fact that people are motivated by the lunar cycle. I do like that. Every community's got them, and it's 5 or 10 or 15 people, but they're the same ones every time, and they're going to show up, and you can't exclude them, clearly, and so you just try to include them and a whole lot of other people and try to make sure that the speakers are prepared to move on or move on to another topic. And so having the right people represent the different county departments is important, too, because, when Dr. Hinton started talking about her ability to quarantine people and stuff, it was awesome. I mean, this one lady just, I thought she was going to pass out. So.
Yes, sir.
If there's one thing I heard from this panel and the other panel was listen, 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 allow people to voice their opinions. On the two essentially case studies we just heard between Los Osos and the general plan update, I see two distinct differences. The general plan update, definitely there's typically no preconceived notions. You go out and study areas and people, the input is really there. In the case of Los Osos, probably 99.8% of the people were against the $250, I'm guessing. I mean, there's probably a huge pushback on the cost. So you're taking something you want to accomplish, and you're essentially trying to convince people. I'm assuming that's the way it went. More so, you're trying to convince what the positives were of the project. How did you take input? I mean, where was your latitude in the input for...
Yeah, in the overall process, because it was very much clear from the beginning that we needed to take a strong position that something needed to get done. And so where the input really was is how is it going to get done? And that was a critical issue when we were working with the assemblymen and the legislation, because the key provision in the legislation was the first thing the county would do is have this Prop 218 vote, and everybody knew it was going to be expensive. If it passed, then the county could continue. If it did not pass, then it was going to, the authority was going to go back to this bankrupt CSD, and then who knows what was going to happen after that. And so that was the important setup through the legislative process. And that way we could enter into it all and say, look, you know, community, you know, this Prop 218 vote is all going to be about whether you want to get something done or not, and then have the input on where is it going to be done. So we evaluated about a dozen different sites for a treatment plant. We evaluated a lot of different collection system technologies. You know, we just went through a lot of work on what were the different options, and then spent a lot of time, too, on, you know, what were the environmental impacts and how do we work with the environmental impacts. And it continues to evolve still because even though we did get Coastal to approve the permit, we still have some financing issues that we still have to tackle and everything. So the input and the participation was more about how we do it and not, you know, whether it needs to be done or not. And then through the Planning Commission, what we made the conscientious decision, and this was a hard one, is we put a project on the Planning Commission's table that was purely a public works project. And the idea is we knew that no matter what alternative we were going to put on the table for the Planning Commission to consider, there was going to be opposition no matter what. So we put a project on the table that would meet the Regional Water Quality Control Board's needs, and then through the Planning Commission hearings, the site got moved. The treatment technology ended up being the same, although we upgraded it a little bit. But we really used that formal Planning Commission process in order to shape the how it gets done. And going in, that meant that on our CEQA, our EIR, had to have a co-equal alternatives analysis of many different project options. You know, typically in an EIR, you identify what you want to do, and then you have to do evaluation of some alternatives. But you're not required to evaluate the alternatives to the same degree that you evaluate the project that you're proposing. But again, because we were going through this very inclusive process and community input process, we did a co-equal analysis of multiple different project alternatives so that through the process and when the Planning Commission made the decision at the end of the day, that it was a project that was already covered by our CEQA analysis. So the input was about how do we get it done, not whether it needs to get done.
That's an important question. I just would like to say, because I think this question about starting from the beginning with clarity about what is on the table is hugely important for a successful process throughout. So it's a great question. Acknowledgement of the distinction. Yes?
This is also a question for you, sir. You had said in your presentation that you had a lot of redundancy in your written material.
Yeah.
What did you mean by that?
Well, the idea that we ended up sending out a lot of different mailers, you know, and we kind of got criticized for sending out glossies. On resource side of stuff, Cal Poly is a good school. We use graphic interns. We got a lot of really good communication stuff out, super cheap. But every single brochure that we had, when we sent out the second one, there was a redundancy from the first one. And it's almost like, you know, when you watch TV shows or whatever and it says to be continued, and then the next show that you watch, they end up spending the first 5 minutes telling you what happened in the prior show. You know, that kind of a redundancy, repeating the message. Sometimes, my stereotypical engineer hates the redundancy, right? He just wants the hurdles. I cross that hurdle, I got to go to the next hurdle. I got to go to the next one. And I'm like, it doesn't work that way. We got to keep looping back and, you know, reminding people of where we were, maintaining chronologies of where we've been. You know, that's sometimes helpful as well. But the idea that, you know, it's just not a linear hurdle. We sometimes have to be redundant and, you know, kind of go back over the ground we have already covered.
So not, you don't assume that everyone has been following the project.
Assume that they have not been, yeah. That's right. And also in the morning I heard somebody speak to the idea of the latecomers. You know, always anticipate the latecomers. You know, you're always, and that's also why the Planning Commission process we wanted to make sure was wide open, because we knew that some people were going to, as soon as we put a project on the table, then, you know, somebody was going to come and scream about that because, you know, finally that's what's being proposed. And some of those were, you know, were the latecomers, so separate from the redundancy issue, but just, you know, always assume that certain things are going to happen.
Facebook, you talk about it. I'm so intrigued with Facebook. I'm not on Facebook. My kids are. My wife's on there. And I'm kind of paranoid. Being a wife, it's more of the paranoia. My kids post things, silly pictures of their dad, and I make them take them down. What do you see? Why do you see that Facebook is so beneficial versus your own website, county website, or email or texting, or what is it that you think sets it apart?
Well, a couple things. One is that you know, most elected officials, if you're just going out there trying to speak to a lot of people or talk to an audience, you know, it's not hard in a county like Stanislaus or even Yolo County to, I mean, I have, you know, a couple thousand people follow me on Facebook. You know, when do you really get a chance as a county supervisor to speak to a room more than 100 people? It doesn't happen very often. I actually put on my Facebook, I said, I'm going to be speaking to a CSAC conference on, you know, community outreach today. You know, give me your thoughts. And so our public information officer responded. A couple of my constituents did with various things. But Facebook is, for me, it really started as an experiment. You know, I was trying to, first at one point, I was trying to see how many people I could get to respond and what really got them to respond. And I found that really it was comments about my kids. You know, my son's 3, my daughter's 6, and so they're doing all kinds of crazy things. So people would comment on that. But I have a story to tell you from about 2 weeks ago. I run campaigns for a living, and I know people will disagree, but Sarah Palin drives me insane. I mean, she just drives me insane, and the whole thing's just crazy. And so when I got this piece of mail from the Carly Fiorina campaign, which my firm was working on, my partner John's on that one, I'm like, and I was running for office at the time. I didn't have an opponent, but I wrote as my Facebook status, If Sarah Palin endorsed me, I'd be too embarrassed to tell anyone. That was my Facebook status, right? Just took 30 seconds, right? A week later, the Washington Post wrote an article about my Facebook quote that I wrote from my basement in Woodland, California. And they went completely, so this reporter calls me, and I was just like, that's really interesting how that happened. I had no idea what the impact of that was. Or I didn't, you know, I just talked to this reporter really briefly, and I was like, well, that's really kind of odd. Well, one of Carly's opponents had forwarded this on to people to say, well, you know, clearly the Meridian Pacific, the firm is divided and they don't like Sarah Palin either, which I still don't like Sarah Palin. But they made a big deal about this. And so there is certainly some danger about the things that you write coming back to haunt you. And I still don't like Sarah Palin. I don't regret having that thought. I probably shouldn't have made it a Facebook post. It was very uncomfortable for my partner who was involved in Carly's campaign for U.S. Senate. But I still do feel that way once again about Sarah Palin, if I haven't repeated that enough times. But my whole philosophy as a county supervisor is very different from mine, you know, in life. For a county supervisor, that's not where I get a lot of my identity. So my experiment that I'm having with, you know, the experiment I'm trying, I would never encourage any of my clients to behave the way I do generally, because they want a career in politics. You know, they want to go do other things. I really don't. I mean, I barely ran for re-election this time. I have no plans on being in the legislature or Congress or whatever else. And so I do take some more – I say some things that maybe I wouldn't encourage other people to do. But you do have to realize that if you're going to be somebody who's going to accept all of the good people from Stanislaus County, regardless of who they are, some of those people are not going to be your political friends out there. And they come with a cost, and they will use those things against you. And some people I know only accept Facebook friends from true friends. I decline people all the time. If I've never heard of them or don't know them, I just press, you know, ignore and move on. I have lots of friends and colleagues who will accept friendship from anyone who, you know, who does it. George Runner, who's now a state senator, he has a great kind of criteria. He does not accept any Facebook friend. His only criteria is anyone who is wearing any sort of swimwear. If you're wearing a swimwear, a bikini or a swimsuit or whatever else, no dice. Everyone else is in, but if you're wearing swimwear in your picture, you're out. And that's his deal. But it does come with some risks. But the benefits are Where do you get a chance as elected official to talk to 2,000 people? And Facebook is quick. It's easy. The response is instantaneous. I have Facebook open generally. As soon as I open my computer, it turns on, because oftentimes I may not have somebody's email address, but I can reach, you know, I don't have their email address or phone number, but it's a roster for me. It's like a directory. And so I use it in that way to be able to reach people. And if I spend a lot of time on conference calls. So for me, that's, I don't spend a lot of time on Facebook, really, but it is an amazing tool to be able to find people. I have buddies from the Marine Corps I haven't seen in, you know, 10 years who will reach out to me that way, college friends. It's an amazing tool. So it does have a lot of viability, but it does come with some risks. And I understand why you'd be paranoid, and my wonderful experience with Sarah Palin, who actually read my Facebook post from Woodland, California, in my basement, would be an example.
So what do you think of Sarah Palin?
Not a big fan, still.
Okay.
Well, and there's I've read studies that say that for every comment you get in a Facebook post or whatever else, there's like something like 70 or 80% of the people are voyeurs on Facebook. They just read. They don't ever comment anything. They never change anything. They're just taking whatever information they can get. They're never offering anything. And so they are, there's one-way communicators, which is they're taking from it. And so you have to realize that if you get 30 comments on a Facebook post, probably 10, 20, 40 times that many people read and took in that information.
I got to agree with you. I'm a fan of my hometown city.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I don't read the paper. Sometimes I don't get the mail with the postcards. But I'll come on and think, oh, they're doing an e-waste, drop off on Saturday. I would have never known had I not gone on Facebook.
Yeah.
And a lot of the politicians and supervisors that do post things, or city council members who are going to discuss a general plan on X, we would have never known.
The other thing I would say is that, and I talked to high school students about this, are you really, open for business? And right now, if you're going to be using all the tools available to you in local government, it's one thing to have a video server to be able to post video, and I understand why that's expensive. Facebook's free. I mean, it's absolutely free if you have the time and the creativity to put stuff on it. There's absolutely no cost to you. It does take a little bit of your time, but to post an e-waste disposal thing on your Facebook status seriously takes 15 seconds. I mean, as fast as you can type 30 words, it's on there, and depending on how many people have reached out to you, that's a pretty good audience and a pretty good return for your lack of dollars.
Matt, do you find that people are expecting you to respond to their postings? Because that would seem to be, Vito said he's paranoid. That's my worry about Facebook, is that if I start putting stuff on there and then we get a lot of comments, that people are going to expect a lot of follow-up. And I mean, I see it as a good tool, but that would be my caution.
There are people who try to engage me in debate on that, and I generally, if it's my comment, I put it out there. I can generally be done at that point. If people want to engage in debate, they can call or email or whatever and get that, but I don't feel any need to respond to some random question that's posted on there. And once again, most of these people, almost all of them, I at least know who they are or something like that. It's not a totally random thing. On my blog, I originally had it so that anyone could comment. That turned out to be a huge mistake. And it was a mistake because people go on there and they just trash other people for no reason. And because it was at rexroad.com, I owned it. I mean, people would say really bad things. Why is that on your blog? I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, just people write stuff. And I owned it, and I didn't like that. And then I had this experience, which actually threw me the switch the other way. I'd like to have it be open generally and have people be responsible. That would be my default. People didn't seem to be able to behave themselves, but when I ran for supervisor, I had somebody go back on my blog and post a comment, and I believe it was one of my opponent at the time, posted a comment, a very derogatory comment about, I believe she posted a derogatory comment about her own body type on my website, pointing out one of her physical features. And so then when this hit piece came out on me in the campaign, on Matt Rexroad's website, says the following. Well, it was a post from 6 months prior. I wasn't monitoring it, didn't care. I never would say that. But in the mail piece, it said, on Matt Rexroad, blog list the following. I had somebody from my church ask me, did you really write that about her? I'm like, well, no, I didn't. But then, you know, absolutely not. You know, I didn't, but I owned it because it was on my site. And that's a much more difficult thing. So I had to cut anonymous comments off to be able to do that. Even though you try to be open and like that, some people will abuse it.
I just had a couple things on our website I was going to show you. This is buttegeneralplan.net. We did buy a domain name just for this project. A few things about the site. We promised early on when we had our very first meeting, we created what's called an e-binder, our electronic binder, and it goes back to the very beginning of our first meeting, April 13, 2006.
That's great.
And every time we had a public meeting, produced any information, it's on this website. There's like, here's the contract for the consultant that we hired. Everything was open, no secrets. I mean, that's a big deal in our process. And again, it's gone a long ways to establish our credibility. So that's been very helpful. Again, it goes back to the very beginning. So we have a library, a history of step-by-step, date-by-date, of everything that we've done with the public.
That's really good.
Yeah, that's great.
We also have a video library. Again, mentioned that with our resources on all these different video servers, so you can go listen to the meetings, watch the meetings. We also have, it's trying to make it easy to find anything. This contains our draft EIR, our draft general plan, and our 1,000-page setting and trends report. And so people could go to our website, request one of these CDs. We mailed it to them for free. Printing all that, the general plan cost about $60. The EIR was $100. The setting and trends report was about $100. And these are free. And this has, and I try to convince people it's better to have these PDFs because you can search them by keywords of things you're interested in and find out where's water mentioned in all these things. And it's better than the paper copy. And so we give these away, and it's been very helpful to our process of getting the word out, educating people about what we're doing. So I want to mention that.
I want to ask one question. I just realized you made me think of something. One of the questions that came up quite a bit today is this question of how do you get people who have not participated, but how do you get them to participate? And I was just wondering, is there any last comments anybody would like to make on the panel before we move on? Is this question about, well, yeah, but they don't come. Is there anything in your work, any of the work that we talked about, that really added to folks beyond the usual? That would make a good way to end any comments that you might have on that point.
I have one. Yeah. Every election cycle, everyone tries to deal with how we're going to do this, get out the vote and rock the youth vote, and we're going to get all these young people to vote. And in 2003, when Governor Schwarzenegger was running in that special election, I kind of missed it. At the beginning, when I left, I went to Iraq with the Marine Corps in 2003, and so when I left, Gray Davis had just been reelected, and I remember getting off a plane and started to try to read the newspaper to get reengaged, and the guy from Different Strokes is running for governor. All this craziness had happened while I was away, and then sure enough, it appeared that Arnold Schwarzenegger was just about to be elected governor of California, and I was blown away. But then afterwards, I was involved in an assembly race down in Southern California, and we took a look at the number of people under the age of 30 that voted in that special election. And you would think that of all of the elected officials, and I talked to you about Bill Clinton today and Al Gore and Bob Dole and the whole gang, but if they're going to vote for anyone, it's going to be the kid from Different Strokes, Gary Coleman, or Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? I mean, you can't get any better named person for somebody under the age of 30. The turnout in the 80th Assembly District was 13% among people under 30 for that election. If they're not going to turn out for Arnold Schwarzenegger, they're not at the time. I mean, his reputation has changed dramatically since then, but whether you like him or hate him, whatever, if you're not going to turn out for the action hero, you're not turning out for anyone. And so we spend a lot of time trying to dynamite people out of their sofas and to get them to go vote. And I actually don't know that that's the best use of resources. The best use of resources to me instead is to make sure you have a process that's available and open to as many people as you can get to come. And maybe it is only the people that are automatically going to be there but give them a structure, whether it be on a computer or town halls or whatever else, and just make sure people are aware of it. And 80% of the people are going to be the same every time. But it's the 20% that might come in and out and whatever else, and you bring them in and you start adding more and more. But if you spend your time trying to get people to come in, that's tough. Instead, if you focus on having a really good open process for those people who choose to be involved, good use of your process, it can work well, because I really think that, and we've all had these times in our lives, you know, when you're a brand new parent and you've got two young ones or a little one at home or whatever else, what is going to get you to be able to go spend from 7 to 10 at night at the Woodland City Hall talking about sewer fees? Nothing. There's nothing. You're not leaving your family. That's just not your deal. And yet you can send them postcards, you can send them emails, you can call them on the phone. The answer is no. In fact, it's hell no. I'm not in that point in my life. But at another point, as long as that process is available and they can find it with just a little bit of work, I think that's a better way to use your resources of time and energy to be able to focus on those things. Well, that's my opinion.
One could say also that you could also offer them an online way to be online engaged.
Sure.
That you may be more options for participation might yeah. also be.
But I think a lot of entities say we're going to try to dynamite these people out of their chairs, and I just don't think that's useful. That's my opinion.
Well, and I think we also have to go to where they are. We don't necessarily have to ask them to come to us. There's a lot of networks that exist, whether they're online, virtual, whether they're civic organizations, congregation-based. There's a whole network of things to tap into. We dabble in a lot of different areas in hopes that we'll strike a chord with someone some way, somewhere, and get them involved with us. And just the other day, a woman from our probation department came up to me and she said, you know, keep up this civic engagement stuff. It's working. You know, she's got neighbors coming up to her saying, yeah, I saw something about the county the other day. I didn't know you did that. Or, boy, there's some tough issues that the county's facing these days. I didn't realize. Whatever it was that got that person's attention is probably different than what might get the attention of their neighbor or their spouse or someone else that they associate with. So I think we've tried to use a one-trick, one-size-fits-all approach, and that's not the 21st century.
Good point.
I agree with David. And the other thing that I would add, especially in working with immigrant communities need networks to survive. They need to know how to find a job, how to find a safety net. I don't know how to use the hospital here. I am in trouble with the police. Whatever the issue is, they need networks to survive. And I think that's very different than U.S.-born communities. A lot of U.S.-born communities, you can survive without connecting. And the exciting thing about working with immigrant communities is that if you can find the one person that's networked, you haven't just tapped into one people. You probably tapped into 100 people. And when they move in groups because they're spreading the word about what are the issues. And they're also watching TV, and they also care about the school budget cuts, and they care about all the similar issues that you're facing. So for me, that's an exciting thing about working with immigrant communities. And I remember one little story that I'm going to talk to you about is that I decided to put my daughters in folklorico dancing, which is Mexican dancing. And you have to buy the shoes and the braids and all this stuff and coordinate them to get them to the dances. And I was like, oh, do I really want to invest in this? And the women knew the work that I did, and they valued the work that I did. And within a week, I had two dresses I didn't have to pay for two daughters, all the braids, all the shoes, because those women knew whose kids had outgrown what, where the next dance was. They had all these resources that they're willing to share with me that I didn't ask for. And for me, it was amazing that there's leadership everywhere. We need to figure out how to tap into it. There's people paying attention. And if we pay a little bit of attention, we can tap into those resources and people bring forth what they have. And so that was, for me, an example of, oh, look at women in leadership. Maybe we don't think about that as women in leadership, but that is women in leadership.
I'd say make sure you have food at the meeting. That's what I'd say.
You want them to come.
And if you can, then they're homemade cookies,
right? Well, we didn't go that far.
Yeah. We've done the homemade cookies on some of our small communities that are population of 1,200 or something. And Tim's right. I mean, that's just like that's the biggest hit. I think overall I agree with Matt. It's making sure that the opportunity for participation is there, that there's just a lot of people who aren't going to, you know, choose to come out. I think it's a long-term issue. There was a comment earlier about, you know, the decrease in confidence of local government or government in general. 200 and some years ago, though, the democracy was considered the great experiment, right? Because we're the first modern-day democracy, and today we're the longest-standing government on the earth. And that's because we consistently reshape ourselves. And what we're doing today and what we're doing in the 21st century is talking about how we reshape local government in order to be, you know, more responsive to our community. So I think as long as the opportunities are there and we go, continue along these paths, then the long-term benefits are gonna be there.
Thank you, folks. Give you a hand to the panel, please. Thank you. We are going to move to the last couple things for us to do. I just wanted to make, before we do that, so I'd say one, if I can move one step. There's, so in your binder, some of these materials, I just wanted you to know they're available. We've done a public engagement and budgeting guide, immigrant civic engagement guide. This is a somewhat older planning public forums piece. There'll be a new one coming out later this year. And there's a couple things forthcoming. We're doing a guide to working effectively with clergy and congregations, which is one aspect of good public engagement that can help you out. And we're doing something, we talked about evaluation, we're doing we're calling them rapid review worksheets. There's some basic forms you can use to assess public engagement activities, so they'll be coming out as well. I just wanted to mention that. So there's only one more activity really I'd like you to do, if you would, if you bear with me. What we're going to do is I'd like to have you break one last time into groups, and we'll stay there until we're done. And then we will, I think that there's an evaluation form in the back binder, the back pocket of the rear back page of the book. And then I think there's also certificates and such. And I think the idea is, and you can folks tell me, I think as you turn in your evaluation, you are given your certificate. Is that correct? So I wonder, though, if you could bear with me and just count up by threes one last time. I want to do a very quick sort of some takeaway discussions from the day. And then we'll do the certificates, the evaluation certificates. So please bear with me inside there. One,